Beware, Spoiler Alliance, you've caught the eye of the Empire. This week on Storm of Spoilers, we dissect Rogue One, A Star Wars Story, the Gareth Edwards-directed inaugural anthology film that is actually just a prequel. Discussion will begin with a fairly spoiler-free segment about Rogue One overall, then we'll dive into the droids, ships, locations, characters, and connections in the spoiler section that asks the right questions and makes the right choices.
The Empire has this kind of power. What chance do we have?
What chance do we have?
The question is, what choice? Run, hide, plead for mercy, scatter your forces. You give way to an enemy this evil with this much power, and you condemn the galaxy to an eternity of submission. The time to fight is now!
Hello and welcome back to Storm of Spoilers off-season tour. My name is Dave Gonzalez, and I'm pledging myself to Saw Gerrera's partisans, the extreme terrorist rebels in Star Wars.
Oh, fantastic. I'm Jonah Ronson. I am pledging myself to the Empire. Don't call it evil, call it efficient.
And I'm Neil Miller, and I would, before I pledge my allegiance, like to apologize. I sound weird. Ever since Joanna told me what she thought of Rogue One, I've been having an allergic outbreak. But I am pledging my allegiance to the rebels, of course. Somebody has to take a stand against tyranny in a way that is not extremist.
Yeah, this is one of less than 10 movies, three movies where the rebels turn out okay at the end. Not great. The rebels never really turn out great, but they're okay. They're okay at the end.
Yeah.
We're, of course, talking about Star Wars Rogue One, the first Star Wars spin-off movie, but it's also a prequel, so maybe the third Star Wars prequel, depending on how you want to define it.
Would it be the fourth Star Wars prequel?
The fourth Star? Did I say third?
Yeah.
Oh, no. Well, that's
which one doesn't
on
count?
Are you saying Attack of the Clones doesn't count? Because I support that.
Oh, okay.
Here's the thing. If Qui-Gon Jinn would have come back in Revenge of the Sith like he did in the novelization, then Phantom Menace being a thing would have existed. But as it is, I don't know if we need that backstory. Because we get to see how well flashbacks work when using the Star Wars universe in this movie. But wait, we're getting so ahead of ourselves. First of all, Joanna, welcome back.
Thank you for having me. Wait, should we from the off the top sort of say, talk quickly about structure for this episode? Because a lot of people are asking whether they should listen to this episode before or after they see the movie.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So
we haven't discussed this previously, so enlighten me as to what we should do.
Oh, I thought we decided this on Twitter. Hello, everyone. Welcome to our process. I thought we decided on Twitter that we were going to do... like talk about the plot up to the first act for the first section of the podcast and then do like a deep spoiler section in the second half.
Sounds perfect. I didn't know that likes were approvals.
Oh, well, they are. Likes are approvals on at Joe Wrote This. So if you're listening to this and you haven't seen Rogue One yet, we'll be talking about and you don't want to hear anything about the movie, then press pause. Listen to this after you see the movie. If you want to hear a little bit about the movie, listen to the first half of the podcast. If you want to go all the way, you're like, this is Storm of Spoilers after all. It's in the title. Then you can listen to the whole episode. Does that sound about right?
Yeah. And if you're skipping around and you find yourself smack dab in the middle of an ad, you're in a break. And that's how you know. It's great.
All right. So I am back from New York City. Thank you for having me back. I am here to read a review for you. This is going to be worse than accents, guys, so get ready for it.
Oh, no.
Okay, this is 5 stars from Paupalina, and it says, Excelente podcast, and it says, for Joanna to read in Spanish if she wants. I think I've done foreign languages before, right? Really shittily? Okay.
We did German, yeah.
Oh, yeah, really shittily. I can do this a little bit better. Okay. Me encanta este podcast. su conocimiento de Game of Thrones. She wrote Game of Thrones, but it's Juego de Tronas, right? I think in Spanish. So
I don't know Spanish.
Su conocimiento de Juego de Tronas es muy amplio y es he disfrutado su tour por otros temas. Keep up the good work. So thank you so much, Pau Paulina. I took 3 years of Spanish in high school and haven't studied it since, so I apologize to everyone for that.
Yeah, no, it's okay. You didn't murder anything badly as you could have.
It's Juego de Tronas is right, because that's the name of a Spanish Game of Thrones fan site, I believe. So that's why I think I know that. Anyway, that's we got a lot of good reviews. I will say this one thing, guys. When I go away for an episode, please don't give Neil and Dave grief, because you know you love them and you know you love hearing them talk. And if you give them grief, then they won't ever let me leave again. And I have to be able to leave sometimes. So I thought Neil and Dave did an amazing job last week.
Wait, did someone give us grief?
Are there reviews about how bad we are?
No. I just saw some stuff on Twitter. And if you guys didn't see it, then never happened. It never happened. I think people just like it when we're all three together. And I think that's true. I'm happy to be back. I love it when all three of us are together. And this is a great episode to reunite on.
Yeah. I could see where they got all pissed off because we like cock teased a huge return to form, and then just Neil and I showed up and we're like, well, this is what we're talking about.
Game of Thrones. Yay.
That was my fault because I missed a flight. It was all my fault. I planned to be there. I'm so sorry. And no one was pissed. Everyone was just sort of like, hey, we missed you. I missed you guys too. So welcome back, me.
Cool.
Well, while we're still in Game of Thrones mode, Neil, some stuff's actually happened since last week's Spoiler Palooza. What's up?
Yes. Well, you know, after we got the Citadel clean back up and the Raven Rookery depooped.
Yep, there we go.
It's now back up and running, and there's a few things. One, the Golden Globe nominations are out. Game of Thrones up for best television drama, although I'm kind of torn whether it should win over Stranger Things, because I really want Stranger Things to win something. And good news for Lena Headey, her first ever, for at least for Game of Thrones, Golden Globe nomination, which I thought, I was surprised to read that. I probably should have known that, but it's weird that she's not gotten any nominations yet, and I feel like this could be the makeup award year for her. Like, it could be the year she wins to make up for all the years she wasn't nominated. So we'll see.
Yeah, it depends. But unfortunately, I would say Golden Globes has a tendency to reward the shiny new thing. Like Rachel Bloom for Crazy Ex-Girlfriend.
You mean like Ray Donovan? I hear Ray Donovan's
show. I'm not talking about nominations, but Dave and I have our things to say about Ray Donovan nominations. But like, no, they like to award new actors, Gina Rodriguez, Rami Malek, you know, blah, blah. So I kind of think this year they're going to give that category to Tandy Newton for Westworld, but, just stiff competition. Those two ladies both gave it all, their all this year. So.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So, cool.
Did I infect this podcast with my
no.
little gold men awards prediction podcast?
No, I just forgot where I was going with the next part.
Okay, sorry.
A couple of actual Game of Thrones production things. One, the show is shooting in Dubrovnik, which is new. They did not, new-ish for this year. They did not shoot there last year, and really, all that suggests is that we're going to get as much King's Landing as we can hope for, and that they'll be shooting it where they shot it earlier in the series. So, okay, not that big of a news now that I've said it out loud. The other one that is kind of a big, that I know you guys will be very excited about, the Sand Snakes are back and shooting for season 7.
Yeah.
Both Indira Varma, who plays, what's her name? Hilaria Sand. and Rosabelle Lorenzi Sellers, who plays Tyene.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. We're spotted on set in Spain. The other two have not arrived yet, but I think that this actually kind of goes to some of the rumors we've heard that not all the Sand Snakes will be A, together, or B, live through the whole thing. So who knows when in the context of the season they are shooting, but it's entirely possible that they're the only ones that survive.
Nipple armor's back? Do we know if nipple armor's back?
Not yet. They've been seen on the streets, which is not an appropriate place for nipple armor.
Right.
But we'll see what happens when they get onto the set.
Normal shirts on the streets, nipple armor in the sheets. I want to give a shout out to Watchers on the Walls URL for this article, which is Sand Snake Slither Spain, which is just someone having fun on their own, which is great.
Right. And they also mention in their piece that there is still the rumor, very spoilery rumor, that two of the Sand Snakes are killed in some sort of sea battle, the big sea battle that's going to happen.
But, right, that that Euron Greyjoy, I think, right?
Attacks.
Yeah, mm-hmm. attacks them. Mm-hmm.
So we'll see how that goes. So that's really all the Game of Thrones news. For more Game of Thrones stuff, listen to last week's episode because we went through a bunch of it. And as we discussed last week, I am very sure that we will be coming back for another Game of Thrones episode sometime after the new year.
Yeah, we'll just put it together. And then, like, right before the premiere, we'll be like, here's what the season's going to be. And then every week, we'll just get reviews about how wrong we were. And that's how we set ourselves up for success here at Storm of Spoilers. Hey, guys, let's pause before we go to the first act of Rogue One, our spoiler light or non-spoiler prep for seeing this movie, for an ad break. And we're back to continue our journeys in a galaxy far, far away. I don't know if you guys know me, Dave Gonzalez, but I'm really into Star Wars. from back in like the early 90s, I mean, I'm a kid of the 80s, so obviously I saw the movies on VHS. But then I think my fandom really grew in the early 90s when we had like this expanded universe and video games that were going on. And the only way sort of for me to interact with Star Wars was to get super geeky about the original trilogy of films. So I used to talk to my friend Nathan Parkhill about, you know, why B-Wings and X-Wings and Y-Wings were different and which things had bombing batteries and different sorts of laser cannon blasts to, you know, what sort of planets matched up with what sort of species. So my, like, natural, accountants for parents geek mind started filling out the spreadsheet of Star Wars in my head. And that was great. And then in 2012, Lucasfilm got bought by Disney. And yeah, we're going to get more Star Wars movies, but it also wiped out all of the expanded universe. So for me, Rogue One, the story of how they got the Death Star plans in A New Hope, which is basically like retconning the most obvious question you have of why would you design a battle station with that small of a flaw that can be executed by one fighter. Now we have an answer. It's in the form of this movie. But otherwise, I feel like a lot of the movie plays as the war part of Star Wars with little Easter eggs peppered in for people like me. And I think, like, your mileage is going to end up varying on Rogue One. I really enjoyed the brief amount of time we got with the new characters, but we don't have that amount of amount of time with the new characters. So sometimes I think that the movie assumes you're slightly more invested than you are, especially around the second act, which we can't talk about. But guys, I'm going to say my pun in text messages was that I was lukewarm on Rogue One because
get
I think
it?
I like
lukewarm.
Yeah.
Get it?
I think I like the Force. I think I like the Star Wars or the Skywalker family line drama, the whole grand space opera part of it. It's not that I didn't like seeing a war movie set in the Star Wars universe. It's just I'm not sure that this is the best, I don't know, format to tell these sorts of stories. It kind of felt kind of Clone Wars episodic or video game for certain parts of it, which isn't bad because I love that type of Star Wars, but is it like the best Star Wars movie? I don't think it is for me. I think it's still below the original trilogy. But I know, Neil, you liked it slightly more than I did.
I did. And what's interesting is that I don't give a shit about any of that expanded universe stuff. Mostly, it's just something I've never gotten into because I don't read because I can't. But
like our president,
yeah, exactly. It is interesting to me that as someone who comes to Star Wars as a fan almost solely of the films of the original trilogy, and someone who understands the deep flaws that exist in the prequels, and really never got into the expanded universe, I think this explored territory that I've always wanted to see, which is the average people as part of this larger war. I don't know if I've ever cared so much about the saga and the mysteries around the saga and the Skywalker so much as I was always more of a...
Will there ever be star peace person?
No, I was. I would have hung out with the Rogue Squadron more, and hung out with some of the, you know, rebel mechanics, I guess, if I existed in a galaxy far, far away. So this, to me, the very idea of Rogue One speaks to me, and I think that as we've determined in our off-air conversations, really, this does. You're right to say that the mileage may vary, because it really does matter what you're looking for in a Star Wars movie. I think I've always just looked for a good ride. And if you're looking for...
And if you're Joanna, then no.
you'll have your turn, Joanna.
If you're one of those other people, sorry.
And I think Dave and I have a very fundamental disagreement on this, because he does seem to enjoy the saga and the sort of magicalness of the Force and this the chosen Skywalker line. And... I'm totally cool with just a crazy space war movie and it being about people who are pretty normal. And so, yeah, so I think I was probably predisposed to be more into this movie than others might be. And in the end, it executed everything I wanted from it. So it's on the question, we're going to work out some listener questions in this segment, but our first question is Rogue One good? I would say yes, absolutely. And that is where our roads might diverge a little bit.
So I want to say that, like, it's my turn now, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
Okay, absolutely. Okay. It's funny because I actually, what I want from this movie has so much more to do with what Neil was looking for and liked. So, I agree with you, Neil, that it depends what you're looking for, but I think I was looking for a lot of what you're talking about, which is this promise that we were going to get a war movie with everyday heroes doing the best they could to fight this overwhelming force of the Empire, that of course it has like political ramifications to our current climate, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that's what the movie was trying to show us. But I think a lot of the trappings of needing to be part of the larger Star Wars franchise gets in the way of that story for me. So if we could just like get rid of every single cameo from this movie, not every single nod to the larger franchise, but like the main ways in which they try to connect this to the larger Skywalker saga, and really just zero in on that Rogue One squadron and their mission, and Krennic, who's played by Ben Mendelsohn, who may be my favorite Star Wars villain of all time. Then I know, yeah, get ready for it. then I think I would have liked this better. It's a shame being, excuse me. You can take that out or keep that if you want.
No, it's just karma. That's what I'm keeping.
Did you just force choke me from Colorado? Being as keyed in as we are to the production around a Star Wars movie, I at least can't help but watch this movie knowing there were extensive reshoots, knowing there was an extensive overhaul from the original pitch, and trying to sort of figure out what was added and what was tweaked. And I may never know for certain, Dave probably certainly has a better idea than I do, but I did talk to John Knoll, who wrote the original pitch. And, you know, he told me in his original pitch, Vader has no lines. He's just like glimpsed in the background and the Force isn't in it at all. So then when I see the Force added in through Donnie Yen's character primarily, and when I see these Vader scenes, to me it feels like it clashes with the movie that I think Gareth Edwards is trying to make. And I like the idea. I would love the idea of there being zero Force in this movie, of this movie being more about, as you say, ordinary heroes and rather ordinary villains, because Krennic is motivated by... I mean, Gareth Edwards told me a lot of background on this character that doesn't necessarily translate into the film, but, you know, that he's lower class than all of his fellow officers. And so he's got this, like, chip on his shoulder because of that. And he's got all this ambition because of that. And that's a human-anchored emotion that I think is really cool versus I'm seduced by the dark side. You know, I follow the path of the light side. Like, these shades of gray, I think, are so much more interesting. So basically, my frustration with the movie has more to do with me seeing what I think is an even better movie struggling to rise to the surface. And, if that makes any sense. And I guess the last thing I'll say before we get into spoilers much later, is that I thought it was visually very, very cool. And I'm not even sure that it might be folly for me to try to pretend that there was some, like, perfect Gareth Edwards movie that got ruined by reshoots or that sort of thing when I didn't even like Godzilla. So I'm not here sitting, like, saying that Gareth Edwards is the best filmmaker in the world. He's got, I think, a really big issue with character, as we saw in Godzilla. So there's some messiness to the heist itself that I really think could have used another pass on the screenplay. But I do have a lot of other good things to say about the movie. And yeah, I mean, I don't know what to tell you. Like, I want to agree with Neil that all we want in a Star Wars is just, like, a really enjoyable ride. But that's how I felt about The Force Awakens, that it was a really enjoyable ride and that the inconsistencies didn't bother me because the performances were so joyful and everything was so just fun and entertaining. And it's not that I mind that this is a darker movie, because I like dark movies, and in fact the darkest choices in this movies were some of my favorite parts, but this, I was unable to gloss over the weirdness of this movie in the way I was with Force Awakens for reasons we'll get into later probably. That's all. Okay, I'm done.
Yeah, interesting. I don't want to probe too far into spoiler territory, so instead, we'll turn to Neil's user questions.
Yes. So I think we answered the first one, which was from @BenTheAnalyst, which is Rogue One good? And I think we can all agree to a certain extent that there is a lot about this movie that is good.
Yes,
it's just,
I agree. Yes.
Your mileage will vary depending on certain factors that we will discuss in depth in the spoilers section. The second question I find fascinating, which is from @WolfsGhost, a longtime listener.
Mm-hmm.
How does it change your perception of A New Hope? And I'm curious first to start with Joanna.
Yeah, you know, this, as we predicted, I mean, I don't think it's a spoiler to say this. As we predicted, like, what was it, over a year ago when we recorded a spoiler special on Star Wars, that this movie ends, like, bang, right up against A New Hope.
Right.
And so, I don't know, I guess the thing I will say the most is, you know, we're not going to talk too much about the Vader stuff because that's going to go in the spoiler section, but it's interesting to have this movie as a lead up to A New Hope, because A New Hope is, I think, a fantastic movie. I love that movie. Who doesn't love A New Hope? You're wrong and dead inside if you don't love A New Hope. But that Star Wars is a more simplistic, cheesier Star Wars, intentionally so, based on, you know,
well, they just don't show the Leia torturing by Darth Vader scene or any of that stuff. And, like, Alderaan never gets a shot from its surface before it's blown up. They dance around it, but it's still a war movie.
No, I don't mean that. I mean, you know, some of the lines are stupid and some of the acting's bad. And, like, it doesn't matter because it's, like, a hokey, fun space adventure movie, right? Like,
right.
And it doesn't matter if your villain is the cartoon, and it doesn't matter, you know, if your hero is also a cartoon, because it's just, like, really fun. But it's so funny when you put this shades of gray movie right up in front of it. Any part of A New Hope that bleeds into this movie looks simple and weird by comparison. Like, I don't know how much I can talk about. But yeah, I guess to me it makes A New Hope look like a kid's movie, which it kind of is. And I love A New Hope, and I don't mean that as an insult, but I feel like this is a more nuanced Star Wars storytelling, and it makes A New Hope look simpler, flatter by comparison. That's what I would say.
Interesting. I agree to a certain extent. I will say that it did add a new layer to the story that exists in A New Hope, especially from the rebellion side, because what we witness in Rogue One is really the rebellion struggling and sacrificing and sort of stumbling toward a really big victory, which in the larger canon of Star Wars, this, as I understand it, is kind of one of their first big victories, which kind of kicks off them ultimately vanquishing the Empire. So I thought that was interesting, and I do wonder, Dave, if you kind of got that same sense as someone who's read a lot of Expanded Universe stuff, or if that only works for people who never read a bunch of books.
I mean, I think the first thing that jumped to my mind after this is I had forgotten in years and years of watching Star Wars that the opening crawl for A New Hope says that this is like the Rebels' first victory, like was right before the movie starts. And that's when they, you know, got the weapons. So I feel like Rogue One gives me a better understanding of the Rebels, like have been like a unified force. Like this movie starts and they're like factions of the Alliance that they have to like fight amongst themselves. And so they sort of unify at the end. So it's nice in A New Hope that, you know, we get to end with the big medal ceremony and everybody's, you know, having a great time and the rebellion's a real thing, even though they just destroyed a super weapon, not the Empire. It takes two more movies or maybe like eight more movies to do that. We haven't figured it out. But I also, what I really liked and what I was hoping that this movie wouldn't let me down for is the Darth Vader that shows up on Leia's ship at the beginning of A New Hope is pissed. He's yelling. He chokes a guy with his bare hands and lifts him off the ground. He's just like completely short with people. And throughout the rest of the series, we never see Darth Vader that pissed. Even when he learns that Padme is fake dead and he says, no, it doesn't like read as actually being pissed. So I was like, whatever you do, Rogue One, show me why Vader's that pissed and don't, you know, don't waste that opportunity. And I don't think they did.
That's a good point.
That's a great point. I hadn't thought about that.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
That almost makes Vader worth it for me. Almost.
Oh my God. Are you kidding? We're going to talk about this.
Yeah, Jesus.
We need to table the Darth Vader talk. There's a lot to say there. This one, relatively quick. This is from @heathen_king, another longtime listener and Twitter follower. You guys are awesome and on it this week. We've heard this is a war film. Which war film does it remind you of? I will get the most obvious one out of the way, which is it's got a very Dirty Dozen vibe to it, because of all the different people that kind of come together. It also, in my mind, has a bit of a Seven Samurai-ish feel. There's no defending of a village or anything, but the different personalities that come together to ultimately assemble the Rogue Squadron at the end is pretty Seven Samurai-ish in my mind. So what do you guys think?
Yeah, I'd say any sort of what do you call it? Pacific Theater? Is that what they call it?
Pacific Theater's good.
World War II movie, because you know, the final battle, I don't think this is a spoiler because it's in the trailer, it takes place on a beach part of a planet. So you've got a lot of Pacific fighting. That's not a specific answer for you. Thin Red Line, right? That's a specific. Is it?
Yeah, oh God, that one has a lot more stalking.
Yeah,
tracked through stuff in this movie.
I'm thinking about water deaths, but I guess there aren't a lot of water deaths. and I don't know what I'm saying. The last thing I'll say is Platoon. I'll give you Platoon. Or Apocalypse Now. Sort of, once again, it's a jungly vibe, but also sort of bombing from overhead vibe. Okay, I'm done.
All right, interesting. I'm going to try to help this listener not by recommending good war movies, but by trying to give them a visual style. I think it has a lot in common with The 13th Warrior, the movie where Antonio Banderas plays an Arab man that helps the Vikings, which makes no sense. But the reason why is when we're talking about war movies, especially on this Game of Thrones podcast, when we've been talking about warfare, it's often like huge groups of people being thrown against each other. And even in Star Wars, you're used to the idea of like the Clone Wars of like, here comes a line of like battle droids. This is definitely like get for cover, you know, be make 10 men feel like 100. Like, we're against the odds, so we gotta kind of fight as dirty as we can. Not necessarily a let's line up and march to our freedom to save Jon Snow sort of war visions.
Right. And there is a lot of, and this actually goes to what Joanna said about the Pacific War movies. There's a lot of like bottleneck warfare where you have people coming out of a tunnel, and it never feels like there are thousands of people engaged in battle, but there feels like there's a lot of like 30 person battles going on at the same time. So, I thought that was really, really interesting. There are moments, and this has a lot to do with the way this was shot. They shot it with the same 70mm lenses that Quentin Tarantino used on Hateful Eight, which I found out touring ILM. they gave us a little VFX tour. And one of the things that Gareth Edwards told me when we talked about it was that it was sort of a nightmare for the focus puller, because the combined with the RE cameras they used had this incredible depth of field. And it's one of those things, and I'm not comparing this to Saving Private Ryan, but there are moments in this movie where there is crossfire happening, and the amount of depth you get is really incredible. So there are elements, there are little flashes of some of that Saving Private Ryan, Beach of Normandy stuff in this movie, which is, it's really cool.
Yeah, I think you're right. You don't need to be in the Pacific to be fighting on a beach with some shaky cam. The last thing I'll say, this isn't a war movie. I think I can say this in the non-spoiler section. Back to the Future. That's a good parallel for our final war. We'll talk about that more later. Okay.
That's all. I'm confused by that.
I'm super confused.
I'm ready.
Okay. And then the last one, which comes from at Lenoir Auteur.
Also does this a long time listener.
Another long time listener.
Great job, guys.
Does this make you want more or less side stories in the new Star Wars universe, which obviously speaks to all the rumored Star Wars stories that are out there and the one that's literally shooting?
Well, so what's interesting, sorry, I'm just going to jump in here. Interesting is that a lot of the other stories that we've heard about are much more concretely connected to the films we saw. So we've got like a Han Solo prequel, or, you know, a rumored Boba Fett movie, that sort of stuff. The original pitch for this was, as I said earlier, kind of so much more divorced from the Skywalker saga, despite the fact that it straddles the prequels and the original trilogy. I am more interested in these stories that are divorced from what we know of Star Wars. I just think it's so interesting to try to define what makes a Star Wars movie outside of the Skywalkers and the characters we already know. And I think Rogue One had an opportunity to do that, and with sort of mixed results. And I think something that Dave and maybe Neil and I have talked about before is they were once called anthology films. Now they're calling them a Star Wars story, but these anthology films giving directors an opportunity to play sort of jazz riffs on Star Wars. I don't know if they'll let them do it again after Rogue One. I really get the sense that Lucasfilm regrets letting Gareth Edwards, and this is me guessing, regrets letting Gareth Edwards have as much freedom as he did in his initial shoot, and them sort of reining that back in the reshoots. And so I don't know that we'll see that again, but I would be interested in that. What do you guys think?
Dave?
I'm less on what Joanna said side, except I do agree with her that I think Lucasfilm is going to tighten it up, but just because it occurs to me that this defines what is a Star Wars movie to me. And so if it's not going to be about one of the characters, and it's not going to be about what I care about, which is like the Force or a government, then I'm not sure that I necessarily need stuff like this. I've got A New Dawn, I've got Tarkin, I've got Lords of the Sith, I got tons of novels that tell smaller stories about characters doing cool things. If I want to go see a movie, I don't want to say come up with go. I don't want to give directors the ability to do whatever they want with Star Wars, because when we let George Lucas do that, we got the prequels, and that's like barely Star Wars. Everything's clean. The Jedi fly. It's just like, it took a long time. It took like a decade of my life to reorient to like being okay that's part of Star Wars history. Or like now I put it, it's like World War II. You need to remember that it happened, but you don't need to relive it every year of your life. So it's like, I am very interested. This hooked me for all the reasons that everybody is going to say is stupid, and what's stupid about movie going, which is like, it was fun characters. It was the ride I needed, but then there were also little threads to lead me down other paths into other novels. And then it led directly into the saga, which I still consider core Star Wars, in like the story that we're telling. That's the journal of the wills. That's the thing we have to get to the end to before I die in order to make, you know, life feel complete.
Well, and I also consider the Skywalker saga the core of Star Wars. Like I'm not trying to like gut Star Wars or dilute it to the point that it's unrecognizable. I think that, you know, we talk about, especially in the context of Marvel, we talk about the ability to make truly distinct feeling films within a large franchise. And I would just like that opportunity for some of the great filmmakers, you know, like Rian Johnson. Like I want his film to feel like a Rian Johnson film, as much as it can in a Star Wars context. The other thing, and I'm interested to hear what Neil has to say about this, but the other thing I want to say, Dave, is that, it should have occurred to me that this film would scratch the same itch that Ultron did for you, which is that you and I disagreed vehemently in Ultron, because I thought it had a lot of problems with the story, and you really got a lot out of the various tendrils that it sent out into further franchise films. Mm-hmm. And it's just occurring to me now that that's exactly one of the reasons why you might really like Rogue One. One of is that it sends these tendrils out to books or animated series or comic books or video games or future films or past films.
We're still in the first act is open, so there is blue milk within the first 2 minutes of this film, and I chuckle to myself, and I'm like, that's how we're going to play it, huh? Let's do this thing.
Neil, what do you think?
I think I both agree and disagree with both of you.
Okay. Huh.
Mostly because I have similar worries to Joanna in that Lucasfilm might tighten things up a little bit, and that disappoints me because the parts of this movie that I like the most were when Gareth Edwards was clearly playing with some of the visual language of Star Wars, mm-hmm. and when he was really thought he was making a war movie inside of the Star Wars universe versus making something that connects to the saga.
Yeah.
So I thought, and I'm also talking about like situations and scenes in battle that don't rely on any specific like iconography or cameos or any of the connective tissue that you needed to have.
Right.
I thought that it felt still very familiar because we're watching X-Wings and Stormtroopers and stuff like that, but it felt very new. So I kind of wish that there was going to be a little bit more jazz, because what they've done is they've put together a group of filmmakers. I don't know about Colin Trevorrow, but filmmakers like J.J. Abrams. I mean, we're going to exclude him for now. Like J.J. and Rian Johnson and Gareth Edwards, who are legitimate Star Wars people, legitimate Star Wars fans, and you can let those people, if they're creative, you can let them be autonomous with your stories, and they're not going to ruin it, because George Lucas already showed how bad it can go.
Yes.
This really goes to me another thing that I learned at the junket, which was Gareth Edwards talking about Michael Giacchino.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone worried about him coming in late, and the score in Rogue One is great. And yes. The thing that you that everyone underestimated when we reacted to that news was, one, Giacchino is brilliant as a composer, and two, according to Gareth Edwards, he is one of the biggest Star Wars fans he's ever met. Like, he has a, you know, like, 7 foot tall New Hope poster in his kitchen. Like, he is legit Star Wars nerd. So I think there are filmmakers out there that you could hand this over to and give them a little freedom to make something different. Otherwise, it's going to get really stale if they are, you know, I think one of the things that bother people about The Force Awakens was the familiarity of the rhythm of the movie. Right. And it's the visual poetry was the same as A New Hope. So I worry that they're going to not learn that lesson. And I worry that Rogue One, successful or otherwise, will sort of empower the studio to sort of contract instead of doing what, like, we've praised Marvel for doing, which is allow directors to kind of put their stamps. And even Marvel's kind of gotten away from it lately. So, yeah, I'm still sort of in for some of these side stories, but if it goes the way these things usually go, it probably won't be good for very long.
I love this podcast because I went in thinking I was going to disagree with Neil and everything, and we agree so much. The Michael Giacchino thing that you mentioned, I think, is really interesting because that's like the Rogue One theme is like a jazz interpretation of Star Wars. You hear like a progression of notes you recognize, and then he goes like minor or something, you know, and like from a, I don't know enough about music at all to be able to tell you like where and when and how, he tweaked these themes that we know so well and introduced new themes. But I just thought that was like the perfect sort of representation of what I wanted from this film, is to be watching something that you recognize, but goes in a direction you don't expect, which we get to a certain degree, which we'll get into the spoiler section. And then occasionally it plays a theme you do know. Like occasionally there is some John Williams in Rogue One. And I just think the balance of that is like one of the elements perfectly done in the film. So.
Word.
Word. That sounds like a good natural break to take a dip into spoilers after a word from our sponsor.
All right. Super spoilers. This is the super weapon of spoilers.
Yes, this is it. This is our Death Star of spoilers. I don't even know where to start this thing. I will start with the question that nobody's asking. Why does Saw Gerrera have a psychic tentacle monster?
Why is Saw Gerrera, why is his character design so close to Immortan Joe? Why is his character terrible? Why is Forrest Whitaker in this movie? Why is Forrest
Whitaker? Because he's the only one who could do the voice.
Is Forrest Whitaker a good actor? After Arrival and this movie, I'm not sure.
He certainly doesn't do accents very well.
I really hated, like, I feel like you could have cut that character easily and still gotten where we need to go. I really hated that character a lot.
I think you need somebody in his place. It was bullshit to make him a legacy character from something else. I'll give you that. But you need somebody that's heading up the terrorist side of the rebels, I think.
Maybe, but the character design was folly. Like, he just had too much going on. Like, I mean, I know that he's based on an animated character, but like, or
the anime character has all of his limbs when we last saw him. So this was definitely a decision.
It's just like too many claws, too, like the respirator, the suit. It's sort of like, it reminds me of like Vader without his helmet on, where like, it's okay for him to be like Humpty Dumpty in like a tin suit for like 3 minutes or how, no, 2 minutes, however long Anakin.
About
in,
45 yeah, seconds.
45 seconds. That's fine. But like watching Forrest Whitaker try to negotiate all of his scenes really pained me. Sorry.
Okay. So this gets at an essential question.
Yeah.
That stems from my argument with a Fighting in the War Room host who's not here currently and is wrong.
Oh. Yes. I like how this is going.
Who can't defend himself. I'll just
So really what this breaks down to me, so we have two sort of major, we talked about Saw Gerrera and how he kind of just does, it's a weird fit, it's an awkward fit. And then there is also General Tarkin, or Governor Tarkin, or whatever the hell his
Grand Moff.
Well, he's not a Grand Moff yet. Somebody calls him Governor. in this?
Gov Moff Tarkin.
I don't know. Whatever. It doesn't matter. Tarkin.
Gov Moff.
So we have two situations in which they could have written in completely new, completely different characters in these roles, and it probably would have worked. So,
I don't know if Tarkin would have worked.
And it could have worked. Well, so you have... you could have written a different character for the leader of the extremists on the rebel side. And really, the reason Tarkin is in this movie is he's kind of the foil for Krennic. Instead of having Darth Vader be there all the time. So the question is, would you rather the movie take the shot at using a familiar character and do something potentially weird or innovative, weird in the case of Saw Gerrera, innovative in the case of the way they animated Peter Cushing for Tarkin?
I think you kind of buried the lead there. Peter Cushing is in this movie as Grand Moff Tarkin.
Right.
So Peter Cushing's super dead.
Yeah, right. 94.
So would you rather them take the risk and sort of fail, potentially, or hilariously fail, depending on your mileage for this one? Or would you rather them have written completely new random characters who didn't feel as familiar?
I am all for new characters, honestly, to be honest with you. I understand why Tarkin, like, why they feel the need to have Tarkin in there, because, Tarkin is in, like, is chief Death Star officer, right, when we get to A New Hope, which takes place immediately after this movie. But when they first introduce him, and like, as soon as I saw the back of his head, I mean, I had heard rumors that Tarkin was in it, but like, as soon as I saw the back of his head, I was like, ooh, it's Tarkin, have fun. And then you see his reflection in the glass. I'm like, ooh, that looks great. That looks so good. His reflection in the glass. Oh, it looks really good. And then he turned around and I was like, no, I hated the uncanny valley of his face. I just feel like the CG, the technology's not there yet for them. Like, and this is someone who really liked like de-aged Anthony Hopkins and Westworld. I just feel like this did not work at all for me. And so I'd much rather like some hokey Dr. Claw shit where you like never see Peter Cushing's full face than what they did here. I would have much preferred that, honestly. If you like forever saw the back of his head or like a sleeve. Ditto to the character that we see at the end. If we had just gone with the back of her, everyone knows who she is for the back of her, and then like a sleeved hand, that would have been it for me.
I don't know. See, okay, so here, I guess here's one of the fundamental disagreements we will have. Yeah. And my question that will help me understand your perspective, because I am here to seek to understand.
Oh, thank you.
Unlike other Fight in the War Room hosts who told me that history... Well, never mind. Sorry. we're not going to relitigate my Twitter argument with Dave Ehrlich on this podcast. But here's the question, though. This is essentially the same technology that Disney and ILM have been using for the Marvel movies to de-age Michael Douglas, to skinnify Chris Evans.
Which is the Benjamin Button technology, as I've heard people being like, what? Didn't they learn anything with Benjamin Button? Yes, they learned this.
They learned exactly to do this. And so I guess the question is...
Is the difference that they didn't have the living actor to map?
Maybe that is. Although... In the case of the person who's at the end, which, since it's a spoiler section, I will say, is Princess Leia.
Yeah, but she's had a lot of plastic surgery. I'm just going to...
Right, they do have...
With much love for Carrie Fisher. Her face doesn't look remotely anything like her face used to.
So, yeah, so I guess that's the question. Is that really the biggest problem? Is that they're not working off of an actor, an existing actor? Is that why it's so much worse here than it would have than it was in, like, Ant-Man?
But like with Ant-Man, de-aged Michael Douglas is just at the very beginning. Like I'd be interested. I could be wrong, but I'd be interested to compare screen time, because I feel like Marvel thus far with young Tony Stark, with skinny Steve Rogers, with young Michael Douglas's character Hank Pym, they're used sparingly, and you're still kind of dazzled by the technology, and then it's over. Maybe not with Steve Rogers, but with Tarkin, he just keeps coming back, and he's got these lengthy scenes with Krennic, and the real issue for me here is I think Ben Mendelsohn is giving an incredible performance. And I think he is one of the most interesting, nuanced, layered characters we've ever had in Star Wars. And so to make one of his major scene partners this CGI confection really bothered me. And then to make another main scene partner, fucking Darth Vader, also bothered me. And like, basically, here's what I'll say. I think the highest point of this movie, and I think I said this to Neil when we got out of the junket, is the prologue, is Ben Mendelsohn and Mads Mikkelsen as Krennic and Galen, talking about the Empire, but also infusing it with all this weighty personal history. You have a setting that you've never seen in Star Wars. It's like you're allowed to hear the wind, like sort of whipping their clothing around. And it's just like, it looks different. It feels different, except it's familiar. And that's exactly what I wanted this movie to be. And all the other things that they brought in, all these other like death to every cameo in this movie, death to C-3PO in this movie. Like, I hate all of it.
Well, that's just so Anthony Daniels can be in all of them.
Yeah, but like, but when C-3PO shows up, you're like, yeah, but K-2SO is a much, much more interesting version of you. Like, that's the problem, is like, Rogue One is giving us much more interesting versions of these flatter characters that we know. And I they don't bother me when they're surrounded by other flat characters, but when they're up against like a really, really, good actor doing a really well-written, I think, character. Well, your mileage may vary. I didn't think Diego Luna got there. Then it's a problem. I don't know. I think
it's interesting because we probably agree on the highs. Like, I agree that opening prologue scene is excellent.
Yeah.
In fact, it's really good in place of a crawl.
Yeah.
But at the lows, they weren't as low for me. Like, the Tarkin thing didn't bother me for two reasons. One, I didn't think it looked that bad. And, it clearly, it's different. It's a unique technology that you can tell isn't a person, but, I never thought of Tarkin as like a specifically emotive character anyway.
Sure. Tarkin's
video,
like,
game version of Tarkin is also fine. But we agree that there are better scenes and better acting elsewhere in the movie. I don't think the lows were as low for me. They didn't pull me out of the movie.
As much
as it may have done for you.
It really did. It really pulled me right out of the movie. And
what do you think, Paulie Gonzalez?
Paulie Gonzalez.
I don't know. I'll pose the same question that I have to David earlier. Could have gotten a response. It's like, does Disney's Hall of President bother you? Because if we didn't recreate Lincoln for the World's Fair, we would not have animatronics, and every single ride you've been on would just be gone from your childhood.
That's a stupid comparison, David.
Why?
Because you don't have like Barack Obama standing next to animatronic Lincoln and like having to compare the two. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
we don't
have Peter Cushing in this movie. We have Grand Moff Tarkin, the character whose estate has obviously signed this off. So, and then you have this actor, this British actor named Guy Henry, who walks in, gives an I'm trying to be Peter Cushing performance, and then over a year they massage it into something that just has to cross your suspension of disbelief as the character Tarkin. I'm not saying I like looked at it and I'm like, there's a human being. That would be stupid.
That's the problem. Like,
why is that a problem? So Tarkin looks more realistic than Pondababa's new gigantic head, which is like much slimmer, and he's the butt-faced guy that
from the
Obi-Wan
tavern.
Cuts his arm off. He's in this
from
movie
the cantina. Yeah
But like, his head in this movie is much larger than it needs to be, and Dr. Cornelius, he's much skinnier than he needs to be. So like, that bothers me. I see Peter Cushing CGI'd in, I'm like, there's Grand Moff Tarkin, because that's what he fucking looks like. And I think that mileage when you're talking about a mega franchise, that mileage goes further.
Can we
than Polar
can
Express,
we pause for
where it's
two
like,
seconds?
Look what we can do.
Yes.
Yes.
I have, I will concede that one of the cameos bothered me, but because of a logic problem, not because of the way they looked. And it is the two guys from the cantina, because we see those dudes, and then like 10 minutes later, that whole city gets blown up. So were they like on their way to a shuttle? or something.
Well, I mean, I think it's like, it's significantly, I think there's like a couple of hours because.
Oh, okay. Because I was like,
we see them.
How did they make it?
Because they're like held prisoner. They have to be transported there.
Oh, okay. That makes more sense. That was one of the things I was like, well, that's a stupid cameo. That whole thing just got blown up.
Well, I mean, and this movie's, if anything, this movie's really good about tracking where these people in to the point where Bail Organa walks off screen saying, like, I have to go to Alderaan, and you're like, and he goes, Captain Antilles, can you? And you're like, that's why Wedge isn't in, like, the next battle, is because he goes to get Princess Leia. And then I was released today on Twitter when a Lucasfilm story group said something I didn't think we know, which is that Rogue One actually takes place after the entire run of Star Wars Rebels. So all the Rebels shoutouts that are in this movie, which I believe are Chopper, you hear Captain Syndulla paged.
So I was right about Chopper?
I think you were right about Chopper.
Yes.
I had to go back and ask people.
I spotted an Easter egg. Dave didn't, guys. That never happens.
Yeah, we only both saw it once. When I see it on Thursday, I'm going to come back and tell more.
I need to take like the tiny little shreds.
Yeah, I mean, that's a pretty big victory. What's a Chopper?
Thank you.
No, he's the droid from Rogue One.
I would like to think it's your droid hate that blinded you to seeing Chopper.
Oh, yeah. No, I saw this guy in the movie.
Yeah, you did.
He was rolling around in the hangar.
Yeah,
right?
He was. Oh, well, yeah. Okay. You know what, Dave? I'll admit this. Neil and I saw that scene twice. So
that's true. We did see that scene twice.
Yeah, we saw that scene twice. So I will take back my victory.
We'll see what I pick up on the next go around.
Okay, you were saying
someone did say that they saw the ship from Rebels in the final battle.
Ghost.
Which
it's in at least three shots. What I'm worried about is if I see it blow up or not, because I was doing like as best I could with my little notebook with the light on it, trying to scribble down the lines before I saw Ghost, so I could track where it was in the battle, because I assumed it was going to be an episode of Star Wars Rebels. Apparently it's not. And I think it makes it through, but I need to see it again for a very specific scene where it looks like the ghost blows up, which would be a weird way to end the series.
I know. Dave's like, that's a really depressing way for all those characters that people have come to love to die. But
but the new information that Rogue One takes place after Rebels means that Rebels could end with everybody being fine and then Ghost could blow up in Rogue One. It would just seem weird to canonically unveil it like that. It's like, oh, you're looking for Easter eggs? Well, check this out. There's everybody you love blowing
dead.
Up.
Like if in the next Pixar movie, the pizza truck just gets into a horrible accident in the background.
Yeah. And just like screaming.
I'm not prepared to be done talking about Grand Moff Tarkin.
Let's go back to that. Sorry I derailed us. I just had logic problems.
Not at all. I guess I just disagree with Dave. It matters to me that he looks like a human, especially if he's supposed to be a human acting against another human.
But when you say that, you realize you're asking for something impossible. Because if they could do it, they would have done it.
I'm asking for it not to be Tarkin if you don't have the actor alive or the proper technology to make it work. I'm saying make it another, like what they needed, according to Gareth Edwards' like assessment of Krennic, is what you need is a really snooty, Royal Shakespeare Academy, accented officer for Krennic's working class personality to bump up against, because this is a story Gareth Edwards wanted to tell that he doesn't quite make obvious, but it's there, I guess.
Well, I mean, it's in the prequel novel, but like that shouldn't be a prerequisite to understanding character.
And it's not like Mendelsohn is doing like a Cockney accent. He's doing his whatever Australian infused whatever he's doing, and it's fine. I have no problem with his accent, but it's not immediately like, oh, this is fucking Tom Hardy or whatever, you know, like this is someone from the streets. So, but that's what he was trying to convey. And so he needs to bump up against a really like snooty Peter Cushing is perfect for that. And I have no problem with the actor giving the performance under the CG. I thought his performance was fine. I just don't think the technology was there. It took me right out of it. The Cantina guys don't bother me because they look like things like they look like alive creatures in this universe, and that facsimile of Cushing did not for me. So that was a major problem I had.
You know what bothered me more than the Tarkin thing?
I'm ready for it. What is
being able to see Darth Vader's eyes through the red lenses of his goggles, which was a new thing that I don't remember from the old There's one like close up shot when he's talking to the Krennic where you can like his eye hole, you know, glasses are red, and I'm like, wait, has that always been there? Or
I'll have to look again for the eyeballs.
You can see his eyes, and I'm like, that's weird. Like that's a clear choice that they made to like give Vader more depth or whatever.
They changed everything about Vader in that one scene.
Are you talking about like him floating in a tub?
Back to tank in Vader's castle, which has been something they've been trying to get in movies since Empire Strikes Back, but keeps getting like revved out. And I've heard from people who overheard premiere conversations amongst the Lucasfilm story group, that's fucking on Mustafar. So it's Vader's castle on Mustafar, and he has black cloaked people that serve him. So like, if we're going to figure out where the Knights of Ren came from, we just fucking saw it.
See, this is why we need Dave. This is why we need Dave.
Yeah, this is why we're doing this podcast.
Right
here.
Okay, so
that just sailed right over my head. I'm ready.
So in the old expanded universe, these people called the Dark Side Elite found that Vader had a castle that he would live in, and it was called Bast Castle, and it was on this acid raid planet called Vajoon. And that was resurrected from Macquarie art for Empire Strikes Back, where we were going to see Vader's castle, which would be on either a rocky planet or a snow planet. So instead it was this acid planet for a long period of time, and that's where the pre-Knights of Ren Vader worshippers sort of gathered to commune with the dark side. This is not exactly Bast Castle, but it's definitely something that is designed to look similar to the Bast Castle that we saw in the, I believe, Dark Forces, Dark Horse comic book, Dark Forces 2, issue 6 is when Bast Castle
shows up. It's not the same planet / place as Return of the Jedi? Or
no,
Revenge
of the
Sith?
It is.
Revenge of the Sith.
Jabba's.
So,
Not Jabba's. The Obi-Wan Anakin battle at the end.
Right, because we saw him flying over lava, right? So,
well, see, that's the thing is that it, like, usually when you see Mustafar, it's like they're lava everywhere and they have to, like, have stilts to hold their things up. This is definitely, it cuts to a planet. The planet doesn't have a title and we see lava and we see Krennic's plane fly over this castle.
Right.
But apparently at the premiere, the Lucasfilm story group were a little loose-lipped at the premiere after party, and one of my little birds heard them say that, yes, that's on Mustafar. So that's the lava planet. And so what we know from existing new canon from Lords of the Sith and Tarkin and all these novels is that's where Vader's been hiding out. All he's doing is healing himself, and he'll bring any sort of Jedi that he finds or any sort of Force-sensitive person to that place and just torture them until they die. So Vader's castle is like this crazy dark side centric place that up until Rogue One has been outside canon, but now it's like it's here. It's something else Kylo Ren would obviously be interested in, want to find. And we see that, you know, guy in a black cloak kneel before the back to tank. He's not dressed in any Imperial anything. He's just a servant of Vader.
Yeah.
And that's the first time we've seen it outside of maybe the Inquisitors and Rebels. So the whole idea that there's this whole, I don't know, cult of Vader, like Vader is still a Sith Lord outside of the Emperor, is all new for Rogue One. So just the fact that there are these two Vader scenes was just like piling Vader knowledge on my tiny little Star Wars brain.
Aww.
And I loved it.
Makes the whole thing worth it. Also,
no. No.
Also, the last sequence with Vader is amazing and completely gnarly. And as Dave said, he's very angry. And I think it also shows you how close he was to not losing the plans,
which is what
really pissed him off.
You know what? If that had been the only Vader scene, I think I wouldn't have had a problem with it. I think it's the Krennic scene that bothered me more.
You didn't like Vader puns?
I hated the Vader puns. And like, and you know I love puns, but like, I love lukewarm. That's a great pun. But like, I don't think it worked with Krennic, but I don't think Vader had any lines in that scene as he was just cutting through people with his lightsaber, right? And,
right.
And I really liked that whole, like, the rebels sort of passing their CD-ROM discs along and stuff like that. Like, cause you know that guy's not going to make it through the crack in the door, but he gets but you know he's going to get the plans out the door. And, so I did. I liked that scene. So if that had been Vader's only scene, I would have been fine with it. But I hated the whole Mustafar stuff. And I'm sorry, Dave, even though it like brought joy to your life. I didn't mean that to be dismissive. I didn't mean that to be shittily dismissive.
I'm glad it brought joy to your life, but it was horrible.
No, I
do think that, and you know, a lot of people complained when The Force Awakens came out about the amount of fan service that it did, but you can't make a Star Wars movie without fan service nowadays, mostly because the people making the Star Wars movie are fans.
Well,
and they're
putting
in stuff they want to see from the expanded canon. So I think
John Knoll is a fan. Like, John Knoll, who is the Lucasfilm employee who pitched the idea for Rogue One in the first place, is a fan. Like, he grew up on Star Wars. He's a Star Wars fan, and he didn't want Vader in this movie. And, like, not that he vehemently is opposed to Vader, but, like, his idea was, let's set this movie in a fallow time for the Force. So, like, and that's the thing is, like, I talked to, you know, you'll read all about this on VanityFair.com when my piece goes up, someday, but, like, I talked to him about the use of the Force in the film, and he's like, well, you know, we really want to make this about everyday heroes, so you don't see anyone, like, get out of a situation because they use a Force. But I don't think that's true, because, like, the implication is that Donnie Yen's character, Chirrut, walks through a hail of laser fire because of his Force mantra. Like, that's the implication.
Well,
he's not a Force user, but, like...
He believes in the Force. So I think that there is... It really is treated more like a religion in this movie than it is a literal thing, which I thought was interesting because, I mean, you can't truly get away from the Force no matter how much they wanted to.
You could have,
but there is still a relationship with the Force, especially if you're going to go to the planet of Jedha, which I understand to be the origin planet of the Jedi, right?
Gareth Edwards.
Well, not origin, but like
their whole.
That's where they used to hang out.
But Gareth Edwards told me they put Jedha in there to work the Force, and he told me that they only got to that after 9 months of working on the story did they come up with Jedha. So like Jedha is put in there, Chirrut is put in there, all that's put in there, and like Jin's Kyber necklace and her holding it and thinking about her mother saying trust the Force, like all of that's put in there to add the Force to the
movie. But I liked all that stuff.
Yeah, and I didn't. So I would trade
all of the non-Force stuff for Donnie Yen's character because he's my second favorite character of the whole movie.
He's freaking great.
He is basically a Jedi without the shitty haircut.
He's got a bow staff instead of a lightsaber, but he uses it kind of like a lightsaber.
He's got an awesome crossbow thingy going on that was very Chewbacca gun-ish.
Also great. Super great.
But I did like that they explored, because if you're going to expand the universe with these films, I like that they explored other people's relationship to the Force and the Kyber crystals and these things that we know are very important to the main saga. Like, I thought it was interesting that the whole thing around Galen was he's brilliant at maneuvering and manipulating Kyber crystals, and Kyber crystals are the power that are used for all the, like, that is all new to me. And I thought really fascinating. I also really like that there are two characters in this movie, one that believes very deeply that the Force applies to more than just Jedis and Sith, and that he's hanging out with his, BFF.
Slash lover.
that he is hardcore bromancing with a non-believer, and that's a really interesting, you know, sort of minor story thread through the movie. I like the whole Force stuff. I don't think they should lose that. I think that's one of the things that connective tissue that connects you to this 39-year-old franchise that you've loved so long is like, yeah, like, what do other people think of the Force? You know?
Otherwise, you're just doing Flash Gordon, which is like, good guy, bad guy.
No, exactly not. Exactly the opposite of that. The Force is the thing that enforces moral binary, where you talk about the dark side and the light. And when I talked to Gareth Edwards about this, sorry if Neil and I are being obnoxious, being like, when I talk to so-and-so about this, but like, but it's added value for your podcast. When I talked to Gareth Edwards about this, he said he wasn't interested in the dark side and the light. He was interested in the gray side. Like, what he wanted to do is show morally ambiguous characters. So you start with Cassian shooting an informant and he's our rebel hero. You have Galen Erso, who does bad things for a good reason. You have Krennic, who's not like, I don't think of Krennic as like this evil killer. He's an ambitious human. And you've got Jyn, who's also got her like muddiness. And that moral muddiness is so much more interesting to me than I'm a good guy. You know, it's Han Solo to a certain degree. Rather than I'm a good guy because I hear the call of the light side, and I'm a bad guy because I hear the call of the dark side, you know, and they certainly fucked that up in the prequels with Anakin, going from one to another. You did not get that middle ground that they might have been striving for. And so that's my objection to the Force. Like, I don't have an issue with Jedi. I love the Jedi. I love like Jedi mind tricks and stuff like that. But like, the idea that there's either a dark side or a light, I think it eliminates the liminal space that this film, at least in one version, was trying to exist in.
Sure. I want to step in.
Go ahead.
I
do think
slightly mischaracterized the Force there, and I don't want to say that you're wrong. I just want to step in and widen it a little bit. Like, the Jedi and the Sith are the ones imposing light side, dark side. The Force is supposedly neutral. That's what, like, the Bendu character
right,
from Rebels is
that's true.
Putting out.
That's
or that's
true.
What they're trying to show with, you know, the fact that the light side and the dark side aren't mentioned here. They are Guardians of the Wills, which is the oldest name we have for anything Star Wars. It was called the Journal of the Wills, Part 1, by George Lucas, written in 1973. Back into my brain all the time. And so the Wills were just like people learning to manipulate the Force, and they predate the Jedi and the Sith. So I totally agree with you that, like, the prequels are just so black and white that it seems it plays out almost, like, funnily. But in all other, like, surrounding Star Wars mythos, they've always kind of talked about that was the problem with the Jedi in that era, and that was the problem with the Sith in that era, is they were both so focused on what they thought they were supposed to be, they lost sight of the other one, and eventually the system collapsed on itself. And so things like, you know, Rey or Churrit complicate what the Force is for me instead of imposing a black and white moral thing. But on the other side, the kyber crystals are apparently inherently good according to Catalyst, which makes it seem weird. So yeah. Not everything in the story is perfect.
I think that they're doing a good job or have started to do a good job with Kylo Ren being the Anakin I wanted to see in the prequels, which is being a human really torn by two sides of the Force. And you see that, I thought, in Adam Driver's performance, and we'll potentially see some of that in Daisy Ridley's Rey if she gets pulled on by the dark side. We have yet to see what Mark Hamill's Luke is like what the Jedi are like. You know, how, I mean, his robe is gray. Like, how gray are the Jedi in this future? But Snoke is just, like, evil. And,
oh, man.
Right?
I have an interesting Snoke rumor, if you guys feel like this is the time and place.
Snoke Snopes. And then, and you hear Churrit say when he looks at Cassian and sees his intention to go assassinate Galen, he talks about dark energy, right? Like, there is dark and light that Churrit sees. He uses the word.
No, he says the Force moves darkly around somebody who is about to kill.
Right.
Right.
So.
Here's a question,
though.
That's
not like, I don't know. Okay.
Here's why it works.
That feels binary to me. I don't know. Anyway.
Here's where it works for me. Because if your entire core theme, which the core theme of this movie in my mind is hope, which is literally the last word of the damn movie, it's about them believing in hope. It's about getting Jyn to believe in the mission, in her greater purpose. It's about getting the rebels to come together around this hope of this impossible task of stealing these plans and defeating a super weapon. you've got to have somebody around who believes the whole time. And I think that's where Imwe, he is a believer in the force, quote unquote, being a guiding force, like any religion would be. Like any chaplain in a military group believes that God is on our side. So it's important to have that if your ultimate goal is to say, okay, now we believe in hope, which is literally the next movie is A New Hope. So thematically, it's a straight line, and you need that character. And I really do like the way they interpret it. I don't think it's black and white. I don't think it's he's inherently saying it's good. I think it's exactly what Dave said, where he believes that the Force exists. He believes that the Force has guidance over them. And he believes that even as a mere mortal, a mere normal, that he can be one with the Force, even though he doesn't have the midichlorian count. What? So I think that's all really important elements to the ultimate end, which is to get hope.
I think you make some good points. I definitely see some great points there, Neil. He's not a mere mortal though, right? He's Force sensitive. Like, you know, he can see things when he's blind. Like, he's not just.
Well, he's like Daredevil.
I mean, they don't
he's
say just, so in the movie, but he shoots down a TIE fighter, so I'm pretty sure.
He's just awesome.
He's a Force
like, he's Donnie Yen. Like,
he is awesome.
Donnie Yen can do that shit.
I really liked him. I really did. I liked him a lot. Like, I'm glad that Chirrut's there. I'm not, unlike Tarkin, I'm not trying, and freaking Forrest Whitaker, I'm not trying to erase Donnie Yen from the movie. But I just think that I think that when you introduce a concept of, what do they call it? Spiritual mumbo jumbo? Isn't that what Han Solo calls the Force? I don't remember. When you introduce that, it takes some of the power out of what you talked about at the very beginning, Neil, which is these ordinary humans doing this extraordinary thing. And so when Chirrut says, I see Jin's path, like I see her path very clearly, you know, that to me means it's predestined. And then, that takes away some of the power of a human striving to do something important.
And that bothered you in the stealing the Death Star plans movie?
Well, and you're right. You're right that it takes away from that, but isn't that kind of what Star Wars is?
But I thought that's what
destinies.
I thought that's what this wasn't supposed to be.
Well,
that
I mean,
usually we watch destined heroes, you know, acting out a cycle of light side, dark side, carousel movements in a certain family. But this was supposed to be the offshoot that's just like, this is what humans can accomplish in this universe. And, that's all I'm saying.
That's how it's like Back to the Future.
Oh, I'll tell you why it's Back to the Future. Here's why it's Back to the Future. Frickin' Riz Ahmed's like, my extension cord doesn't connect. Oh, damn it. That was the Back to the Future moment where I was like, did he learn nothing? Like, you know.
I would have liked Back to the Future part 3 a lot more if he's like, Doc, I'm back from the future. And then a grenade blew them both up.
Here's what I'll say. You know, we're deep in spoiler country, but like, I love that they all died. Made me really happy. Not because I didn't like the characters, just because like that's, we talked about that being the ending a long time ago. I think that's the only ending they could have had. I think it's really brave for Disney to put that on a Star Wars movie. And I'm really glad that they did it. I thought the heist itself, I mean, if we want to call it a heist, the mission was like kind of terrible. That there were a lot of MacGuffins like, get the power switch at the bottom of the whatever and plug this thing in. You know, they needed like an Ethernet cable that, you know, and their Wi-Fi signal wasn't strong enough. The file was too large, so they needed Pied Piper to like decompress it for them. Like,
sometimes we can fly in space. Other times we just stack all our hard drives in a column and what the fuck.
So like, I kind of hated, I will say, all of the details of the final heist. And I just think overall the thrust, like if you have a heist movie, and I think we talked about this a little bit when it, like Magnificent Seven versus Ocean's 11, it needs to be like, which is not a heist, Magnificent Seven's not a heist movie, it's a team up movie, but like your trajectory needs to be really clean when you're dealing with so many characters like that. Everyone needs to have an important job to do. Riz Ahmed's job can't be connecting an extension cord. Like, it can't, I think. And, or if it is, it's just like, it didn't work for me. Like, all of that didn't work for me. Their deaths worked for me. I thought they were emotional, especially K2. I thought that was really incredible. But I don't know, just the logistics of the final battle felt really sloppy to me. So
I feel like they could have let Baze shoot like 12 more people before he died, and I would have given them the implausibility. Cause he starts doing the chant.
Yeah.
The Chirrut chant, and I'm like, oh shit. He's gonna like unleash his thing. And then he shoots like two troopers before he dies.
I know, it's not even that. It's like he shoots a trooper, the trooper drops a grenade. He doesn't really move. He's just like, okay,
Shit.
Or also, what's the point without Chirrut? I'll go. It's fine. I really liked when the Imperial Walker showed up because, you know how well Gareth Edwards does monsters. Like when the Walker shows up and Baze shoots him, and the walker sort of like shakes it off.
Yeah, just looks at him again.
Yeah, I was like, that's one of the most human characters in this movie, actually, is that walker. And I like the dogfight. I liked all the dogfight stuff. I thought that was great. I love.
Did the legacy footage there make you mad?
No.
So I should assume that people have seen the movie. The Red Leader and Gold Leader footage, I believe, is straight reused from A New Hope, or they're doing another digital resurrection that is just better than the other two.
But this is what I'm talking about in terms of of timing. Like if you have like a pilot in a cockpit and you flash them, then yeah, go for it. Use your CG, but don't try to make like a full character out of it.
Well, the only reason I think this is legacy footage is I think Red Leader's lines are exactly the same when he's on screen as in.
Well, yeah, and it actually looks kind of like old footage. Like there's actually like a, if you look really closely at it, so next time you see it, there's like a, there's almost like a proportion gap between them and the live actors, the more modern actors doing it. Like their heads look bigger to me.
Oh, interesting. Versus Captain Handsome Mustache.
Captain Handsome Mustache is like the best. What
he's
else?
So
is that guy's doing something else, right?
I don't know. He looked like someone I should know. I'm like, eventually you'll recognize
he's
who that
Blue
is.
Blue Leader. I can't find. I feel like he was also like a handsome mustache guy in something else. That's like his thing.
Captain Handsome Mustache. I'll figure it out while we talk about this. I do want to talk about the characters of Jin, of Cassian, mostly Jen and Cassian. I have some issues. And I think that has to do with like maybe scenes getting cut, but I have some issues with their arcs. Did you feel like Felicity Jones is so good, but I also think Diego Luna is usually good, but Cassian, I had some problems. What did you guys feel like that character fully worked for you?
There's a soft middle act in this movie where both Jin and Cassian, become really committed to a cause that I wasn't completely sure they believed in the first place.
Right.
And that gap I could feel. But I don't know if I felt the Cassian gap as much until after the movie was over. I'm like, we never figured out what his backstory was. Like that seems a little weird, but I think the Jin thing worked for me. But I think that her switch should have been, completely at Saw Gerrera's place. And they sort of waited until she actually got to see her father before trying to convince us that the switch had happened. But for me, it's like she sees her dad say that he gave his whole life to make this trap. That's when she should have been all in. And I think they spent a little bit of time on that rainy planet doing nothing for the characters.
Oh, God, that was awful. Like, killing Galen and having her have that, like, death scene moment with him was good. But, like, Cassian going up to shoot him and then he doesn't want to shoot him and then he's like, Jin, no! When like 2 seconds ago he was like, Jin, I don't trust you or believe you that I think you made up this hologram footage of your father just because you want to redeem him or whatever. Like, I hated all of that except for whatever Ben Mendelsohn was doing because he's perfect always. Really quickly, I want to say that Captain Handsome Mustache is actually General Handsome Mustache, General Merrick. And I know him best from House of Cards where he played Captain Handsome Photographer who has sex with Robin Wright Penn.
Wait, his last name is Merrick?
Yeah, General Merrick.
Oh, that's interesting.
What is that a legacy thing we should know?
Oh, the old Blue Squadron leader for the non-canon Battle of Yavin was Merrick Sims. Video games. I played them in the 90s. I don't play them anymore.
We should say, well, can since we talked so much, since I like whined so much about Tarkin, can I do want to say that I thought all the Mon Mothma stuff works perfectly. Like, I thought that was fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
So that's and a way to do it.
I will say this. The Leia thing is abrupt, I guess, in the fact that you see her face and it really does look like young Carrie Fisher. I think that's what throws you off, is that's a person you know exists as a much older person. And when you see it, it's like, oh, that's close. Like, that's close. My mind went, that looks weird, but it's close enough. Good job.
I thought it looked
Whereas
like...
I think everyone else is like, that's stupid. Why even try it?
No, I just think it looked like Muppet Carrie Fisher. Like, it looked just too smooth and wrong and weird.
How dare you? Muppets have a felt-like technique.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, you're right. I shouldn't besmirch Muppets in that way. She didn't look felty at all. She looked plastic. And once again, and no, I'm not going to talk about that. But... Yeah, I don't know, because once, like, young Anthony Hopkins in Westworld really worked for me for some reason. Maybe because he doesn't, like, talk that much. The talking...
I don't know. The walking version of young Anthony Hopkins in Westworld did not work for me.
Well, he had his head down. He was going really fast. So I kind
of... I'm just saying, like, that is an example of picking a non-confident angle, where I feel like all the Tarkin examples, they are picking really confident
angles.
Yeah,
but they
Everybody
shouldn't
knows
have been,
how to light Tarkin cheekbones in the Death Star.
But they shouldn't have been so confident, is what I'm saying.
Maybe. I mean, I thought it was pretty cool. So I'm sorry that it didn't work out for you, Joanna.
Thank
but I'm
you.
Almost positive this is not the last nor the most offensive
no.
digital resurrection we're going to have.
I do feel, I almost feel like there is... There's like a visceral reaction to it that you either have or you don't. And if you have that, it stands a much better chance of bothering you enough for it to be a problem critically. I don't think I have that visceral reaction to this. Like, I don't think there's nothing inside me that moves either way when I see a completely digital character. Like, my mind knows what it is. My mind knows that Peter Cushing does not live on this planet anymore. But like, there's no other reaction. I guess my mind is just like, no, it's cool that they tried. Don't worry about it.
I just like the idea that somewhere the Doctor Who team that worked on the huge special with Matt Smith is like, just turns out, goes to the movies and sees like a completely digitally recreated Peter Cushing. Is like, what the fuck? God damn it, Cher. We could have had our 50th anniversary special could have been awesome. It could have had Peter fucking Cushing Doctor.
Ugh.
I don't know how to make you happy, Joanna.
Just be you. I like you so much. give me more deleted scenes of the like potentially gay backstory of Galen Erso and Krennic, and like how Krennic is definitely in love with Galen Erso. That's my game.
There is a lot of bromancing going on in this movie. Yeah. Because, and you know what, another complaint that I saw might have been literally in our text thread, but the the notion that there's like a love thing going on at the end between...
Oh yeah, I just said that I thought it got there too quickly.
I didn't read it that way, like at all. I just read it as like, they just totally realized that this is the last person they're going to see, and they went through some shit. So
whereas I had a lot of New Yorkers text me that they were mad that they didn't kiss at the end, like that there was no kissing in the elevator or on the beach. Yeah. So I think a lot of people,
were shipping it
with two X chromosomes, felt the, you know, a love moment there at the end. Diego Luna is in his
sure
tight
I mean who
pants.
Wouldn't want to kiss that dude. I just think that they got to a place of, you know, they just sort of figured out that this is the end, and they came to this mutual respect, because their whole journey together was about not trusting each other, not knowing what each other was really about, and eventually coming around to the same exact side.
I wish I had seen that movie. I like that movie that you described, and I think
that's
I
the see, movie that we saw.
I just feel like that there's a, when he goes like Jin-No in the rain, I feel like he's in love with her, and I don't know how he got there so quickly. But
you
there's
know
also like
that's really interesting to me, because I read that also differently, because I read it as he's an operative and that's his asset, and he would be super in trouble if he lost her, because she's the only one that saw the message. So it's like if she dies, he's like shit. There goes my information.
He didn't believe that the message is real.
Well, maybe
we don't know, because he just suddenly believes once they get back to Yavin 4.
I mean, it makes no sense.
Right. Like maybe there's some posturing because he still wants to go and complete his mission of killing Galen.
Or maybe there are scenes that are deleted.
Yeah, but I read that as like he just doesn't want to lose the asset that he's curated.
You think that there's more character in the Gareth Edwards version?
No, that's a good point. It's a great point, Dave. And Dave is the best person to speak to this, but I rewatched a couple of the trailers, having talked to Dave and seeing a couple tweets about how much footage is in the trailers that's not in the films. And there's this whole scene where Cassian says like, well, if you're going to fight, I'm going to be by your side. And then the two of them are in a ship, both driving the ship. And I believe we don't ever see Cassian and Jin in the like driver and passenger seat. It's always K2.
Nope. The smiling church.
Yeah.
Where the whole group of people is around him.
Yeah.
That's not in it.
Yeah.
She's
yeah.
never in the Death Star tunnel by herself and turning around and gets lit up, because that never happens.
They're never
TIE fighter at the tower at the end.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're never running. There's a shot in a trailer where a really beautiful shot where they're like running through this field and there's big walkers shooting at them.
Yeah.
That's
but it's the Cassian Jin stuff that like that the fact that there's a whole thing there that's not there that I'm wondering.
I almost feel like they pulled back from the potential romantic stuff.
They might
after
have.
Because one of the things we heard about the reshoots was they changed a lot of the ending and a lot of the dialogue. So maybe they pulled back on that stuff because they're like, well, they're all going to die. So maybe
Let's
we shouldn't
make it
have a
too
romance.
Sad. Yeah,
right.
Maybe.
Like this is like a PG-13 action movie for families and shit. So let's not go too dark.
How do you think kids are going to react when like K2 hits the ground? Because that was like. That's
pretty dramatic.
It's pretty bad.
That's a rough one, because not only does he die, he dies
like so heroically.
In a very extended heroic horrible way.
Yeah,
I'm gonna say okay. I don't spend a lot of time around children, so don't take this like coming and going. But I'd say like 7, 8 can handle it, but are gonna be affected by it.
Yeah.
But like affected like I was affected by Darth Vader. And shit like that. So I don't think that's necessarily bad. Like, the Empire is bad, and that's fine. But I don't know if it's like... I feel like you could, you know, like, show a 6-year-old Star Wars, and they're not going to be scarred. There's some dark shit in here.
I guess it's going to be like, oh, what's its name? That Ewok that dies?
Oh, just the Ewok that dies?
Clearly very memorable.
Doesn't it have a name?
I'm sure the Ewok that dies has a name, but it's not Wicket, the famous Ewok, so who cares?
Okay. Yeah. I'm Googling Ewok.
Are you like searching
name.
Your head for more Ewok knowledge?
Nanta Ewok is knowledge? The Ewok that dies. No, you know what? It's not. It's not as traumatic as when that Ewok dies, because Ewoks are adorable little teddy bears. We barely knew that Ewok. We got to know K2. Cared about him, died for his humans companions, and it's I'm not mad. It's in there. I'm just saying it's some rough
it's tough.
Stuff.
Okay,
it's a tough
the
moment.
Ewok's name was Nanta, Nanta.
Yeah,
it does. Yeah.
I will say this though. Almost the entirety of the third act is structured in a way, and they play it out in a way that there's no way they survive. Like.
Right.
Like, yeah. I was thinking with, like, 10 minutes ago, movie,
like,
I'm like, oh, yeah, no, they're all going to die. Like, they're going to do it. And I was thinking to myself how impressed I was with that, because they really did sort of play it out in sort of a slow way of, like, I mean, their ship blows up, the shield thing. Like, there's just no way that any of them survive that. So I think that makes it less traumatic when they do die. It's heroic, but it's not traumatic.
I feel like we knew that Cassian and Jin had to die because if they didn't die, like, why aren't they in A New Hope? But, like, I think it's possible that, like, Chirrut and Baze and, like, Riz Ahmed's character, whose name I can't remember, that they could have survived and conceivably not been at the center of whatever next mission there was. But someone was pointing this out to me as sort of like actually a number of people pointed this out to me from different screenings that, like, once the minorities started dying, which is like all the male leads, they were like, no way is the white girl surviving. No way are all these minorities throwing themselves on a bomb so that the white girl can live. That's not happening. They're all going to die. That's what they were like, yeah, once the non-white people started dying, I was pretty sure Jin was done for. I was like, oh, that's interesting. That didn't occur to me. But
yeah, I mean, it's not a horror movie.
Yeah. So,
the fact that she's exactly. A white girl who kept her clothes on the whole time doesn't necessarily mean she could still live.
Right. So, yeah.
Well, guys, I feel like we should turn this down a bit and let people go see Rogue One on their own.
Yeah, if you made it this far, sorry, we totally spoiled all of it for you.
Yeah. Well, it's a lot of stuff. And if, you know, you'd want to go see it again now that Joanna has failed to change your mind about how awesome Tarkin is. you should go do that and let us know.
And for the record, I'm going to go see it again on Sunday at the Alamo Drafthouse with friends, because it's always a different experience going, like, with a room full of fans versus going to a screening. So, you know, I'm going to have another go at it. I didn't hate it. I would give it a B.
That's pretty good.
Right? B, anytime that Tarkin's on screen, an F. I stick by what I said about Krennic being my favorite Star Wars villain. Kylo Ren's close runner-up, and that's it.
I will also say this: if you go see the movie, which I hope you all do because it's worth seeing, and you are okay with the Tarkin thing, there are much better targets out there for your rebuttals than Joanna. His name is David Ehrlich, and he is the co-host of Fighting in the War Room.
Ooh,
and
I'm gonna have to take this fight to him tomorrow.
He absolutely deserves what's coming for him when everyone sees this and realizes it's not that bad.
He said it was the worst thing that happened in 2016, and I'm like, I feel like this devalues your politics opinions and his responses. I feel like this devalues your movie opinions. So that's the level we're already at.
Oh, you guys, David Ehrlich he's just being Ehrlich, but, like, that's at David Ehrlich, DavidEhrlich, if you want to find him on Twitter.
Yeah, he made a great countdown video you saw this week, but this next following week, he's wrong. So you can let him know both things.
But right.
he's more wrong than Joanna.
To David's credit, like, he doesn't love Star Wars, but he does love Gareth Edwards and Godzilla. He likes Rogue One. He thinks Tarkin is a train wreck, but he likes...
Well, and he also likes Peter Cushing, which I feel like I don't want to make it sound like feeling uncomfortable about technology reaching into the grave and pulling somebody out is bad. I'm just saying it's going to happen, and I think it was done well. And
yeah, I mean, I'm not coming at you with any sort of moral objections that, I mean, maybe I should have them. But this isn't about, like, morally plundering a man's legacy. If so, like, I should have gotten there with Oliver Reed or Laurence Olivier, et cetera, et cetera. No, this is just about it not looking good enough to me, to my eyeballs. So.
Fair. Cool. We're all people with opinions like we celebrate every week on Storm of Spoilers. Until next time, where can we find more of your work on the internet? Mr. Neil Miller.
You can find me at filmschoolrejects.com, where I've written... And we'll continue to write many things about Rogue One, A Star Wars Story. And follow me on the Twitter at Rejects, where I will continue fighting with David Ehrlich until he concedes, which is pretty much forever. It's going to go on forever. Also, make sure you follow the show at Storm of Spoilers. And you can also get us on Facebook now, facebook.com/Storm of Spoilers. Or if you have questions, comments, whatever, you can email us, stormofspoilers@gmail.com.
Joanna Robinson.
You can find me on vanityfair.com sparingly this week because I'm on vacation. You can find me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This, and you can listen to me talk generally about pop culture on a new podcast called Gen Pop. You can hear me on the Vulture TV podcast this week. That's it.
All right, and I'm Dave Gonzalez. I blog at Geek.com and in Thrillist.com. This week on Geek, I will be discussing Rogue One's connection to the Legend series, much more on that Darth Vader castle And on Thrillist on Monday, I have a deep dive into what it took to make Shadows of the Empire, the novel, video game, comic book, toy, Star Wars from the mid-90s. So make sure to check that out. We are, of course, the Storm of Spoilers. You can get us at stormofspoilers.com or fightinginthewarroom.com/gotspoilers. And until next time, guys, when we will be discussing our holiday season, our TV year in review, keep enjoying this 2016. Worse things have happened than digital resurrection.
Eclectic method. Lightsaber.
Lightsaber.
Weapon of the Jedi.
Jedi's weapon.
This is the weapon of the Jedi.
Only Jedi's carry that kind of weapon.